Propagating truth in a world of lies. You are listening to the John Age Project.
And welcome to the Anomic Age. I'm your host, John Age, and you have indeed entered into the Anomic Age. If you're not paying attention to the media out there, you may not know what I'm talking about, but You might be in the Anomic Age if there's some blanket censorship of conservative thoughts online. You might be in the Anomic Age if there's trans kids selling you shoes and gay cartoon characters for your children. Oh, it's all kinds of goodies to get into today in the news segment of the program. But before we get into any of that, please make sure you check out AnomicAge.com. Send that link out to your friends, family, loved ones, and enemies. Please share it on your message boards, on your Reddit, Twitter, any kind of social media you got. I always neglect to say this, but please like the videos. I guess I should be obvious if you're doing that social media stuff that I don't do all that much. But please like the videos. Brightion, YouTube, you can find all that links on AnomicAge.com. Share those links, post positive comments, the usual suspect stuff that you would do to try to avoid the media censorship, the blocking, the downing of numbers, all that stuff that you can do. That's what you need to do, for sure. I've been thinking about this, talking with the guest that's going to be on the program a little bit before the show and a few days ago just to do the preparations and stuff for it. And I've been thinking about this in relation to the marketing thing, because I've again talked to some more marketing people, and it's kind of the same shtick. It's like, well, you're really going to have to give Facebook or Google all that information. Yeah, your ID front and back. They're going to have to verify your address. They're going to have to verify your phone number. Just to advertise on their illustrious platform, to which I say, insert expletive here. Oh, those of you who don't know me, you can only possibly fathom how I feel about being told what to do. So, needless to say, I guess we won't be boosting any posts. And all those marketing geniuses at Facebook are going to have to just do without my lovely services, I guess. It's so funny how they continue to taunt me with this stuff. They still send me these emails like once or twice of seemingly a day going, well, you know, you could reach thousands if you just played the game. All you got to do is send us your ID and send us some confirmation of your phone number, and let us send a letter to your house with a code so you can confirm that too. And then you too can be a prostitute in the game. Yeah, it's really frustrating, man. The marketing thing's really irritating to me. But I think we're going to have to take it back to the old school. Yeah, we're going to have to do that. Yeah, I mean, if you're like me and sort of had 2 feet in the punk and hardcore movement back in the day, you know all about zines. And I caught it sort of at the late 80s, early 90s, before the internet. And in the era of zines, and then in the era of people calling people up and sending people letters in order to schedule shows, in order to communicate from city to city. And they'd have the bands going on tour, and they'd get to contact people in Richmond, people in Raleigh, people in Atlanta and Boston and all up and down the coast. And that's kind of how it worked. It was a word of mouth thing. It was a very grassroots DIY kind of thing. And I think that's where the Patriot movement needs to go. I know it is. I think many people in that quote unquote movement may not really identify with the punk and hardcore movements or those tactics, but by God, it worked. That was way before the internet. I mean, people had the, what was that silly thing they had? The dialer. It was like a way to basically scam a phone booth so you could call for free. But anyway, I think we're going to have to go back to that because the social media, I mean, barring social media sites like Brighteon and perhaps a handful of others like Gab and so forth, I mean, the social media is not your friend. You may be able to play in that garden for a while as long as they deem you a marginal enough threat to not censor or to not play with your numbers or so forth and so on. But at the end of the day, it's kind of like that analogy I was talking about last week with pimps and hoes. At the end of the day, you're playing in their territory, and you are their hoe. The social media giants are the pimps. And if you fail to follow their rules, the pimp hand is strong. They'll take you right off the platform, right? Laura Loomer? Right, Alex Jones? Right? Right, Milo Yiannopoulos? Right, John Rappaport? So I think we're going to have to usurp their tactics by using our own tactics, by taking it back to the old school. And definitely, you know, if it comes down to snail mail, then that's what it shall be. I think that's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to get around their media monopoly by talking to each other and working together. I think that's another, you know, far be it from me to get on a hippie platform because, Lord, that's not me. But unification is always the key. And I think the last thing the media monopolies want is any sort of unification within the Patriot movement. I think that's what a lot of these what a lot of these things are that you see out there. They're a great diversionary tactic. They're a great way to divide the camps up into these people believe in this entity and these people don't. I think you know what I'm talking about. And I think, you know, there's way too much infighting. There's way too much of that nonsense. I don't want any part of that for my money. I don't want to fight with anybody. I want to tell people the truth. Do with it what you will. I'll just keep tossing thought grenades out there. I don't care about any of that old infighting nonsense. Doesn't help us. The colloquial us doesn't help anybody. But I think that's exactly what they want. But we gotta take the power back, so to speak. I'm using so many cliches right now. I'm making myself sick. But absolutely, there's nothing else you can do other than to work around that system. So if it means snail mail, okay, we'll do that. If it means calling people up, I think we should do that. If it means texting people, if it means CB radios and ham radios and sending cassettes through the mail, I think we need to do that. It may not be pretty, it may not be glossy, and it may not be as easily accessible as YouTube and Facebook and Twitter, but so be it. That's fine. Oh boy. That's my soapbox talk today. No, it's not. I got more. I got a lot more. I talked a little bit about this last week and the previous weeks. I try not to, and I know that's not what you should do. I get it, folks. So don't hit me with the email. You really need to go out. I know. I need to go out and talk to the people. But it's hard. And I know it's not supposed to be easy, but it's physically draining. I try to self-isolate. I'm a big fan of that. I'm a big fan of isolationism. I think that's pretty much what America needs to do. But I digress. Yeah, it was Mother's Day weekend, so happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. I don't want to leave you lovely ladies out, so thank you for doing all that you do. Good grief, you need more credits. But yeah, being Mother's Day weekend, the fam went out a little bit on Saturday. To be honest, we weren't doing anything when you think of family activities, the zoo, the park, we weren't really doing that. We were just doing stuff together as a family, which is always good. But again, we had to immerse ourselves in the people. And I'm using that term quite loosely, because if you've gone out amongst the people lately, whew, it's a big question mark as to how human the humans are. But yeah, we went out amongst the people. And it's always distressing. And I always, whenever I do it, I come back home and I feel like I have to cleanse myself and just talk about it. Talk about it for hours on end. You know, I know my wife's going, I know we're going to have to talk about the people. I don't want to talk. Yeah, I get it. I don't want to talk about it either. I feel like I need a cleansing therapy session. I need to go in and be like, hi, my name's John. I just had to go be around the people today. And whoo, it was scary and terrifying. And I want to. Yeah, I mean, that's how it is. And I don't mean to sound demeaning when I say this or condescending. That's not my trip. That's not how I'm trying to come across. I realize I need to reel myself back in sometimes because I don't know how to articulate things without being somewhat offensive. So I'm working on it. I will work on it. I am working on it. I'm going to continue to work on it. But it's hard. So hard. So we went to a store because we had to get some graduation-y stuff for some friends. I was going to get some balloons. So we went to one of those stores where everything is, uno, dinero. And that was just frightful. And then we went to the local mall. I want to do a whole story on this. I want to really get some guests on to talk about this. On the destruction of the malls across America. I want to really get into that because they've all turned into these crime cesspits. And they went from these big monuments of consumerism to these monuments of crime and despotism. So I'd really like to get a guest on to discuss that at great nauseam. So if you know anyone or if you are that person, please, john@anomicage.com, let me know. But we went to the mall. There was someone working I wanted to speak with, and yeah, it was a lot of stuff going on, but I feel like I need to brace myself. Everyone in normal human land should probably brace themselves when you go out in public. And I think the mall, I mean, when I was younger, it was this glory days of malldom. You know, it was the 80s and it was all kinds of commerce and activity and kids in middle America and just Americana, you know, the 80s and even the 90s a bit. And I hate to break it to you, but if you haven't gone to the mall lately, it's not that. It's not that at all. It has become this total den of iniquity and bizarre paradox of what it once was. It's so, so sad and scary and bizarre. I mean, I don't have enough superlatives to throw at the wall here to properly cover it all. But, yeah, I mean, the mall was just, it hit me earlier today because I was listening to something and it just resonated with my thought process of the weekend and everything else, is that it's really watching the slow motion decline and inevitable death of Western society. That's what it is. So that's kind of what it represents to me when I have to go out amongst the people. And that's what the mall is. It's like the complete pinnacle of all those things. And it's so distressing. It's so sad. Overall, when I'm sitting there watching the death of America firsthand, I feel like, I mean, that's what it is. Like going back to my anthropological roots, I feel like I'm doing a field study. I feel like I'm out in the aboriginal jungle of fill in the blank when I leave the house, 9 times out of 10. And that's what it was like this weekend. And it's so jarring. It's so startling. And it was just like, man, it's sad. I mean, that's what it hits me as a man. I think you get anger, and it's really a mask for that sadness that you feel in your gut because you don't want to witness this. You don't want to see America's decline. You don't want to look. I always refer to it when I leave the house. It's like I'm walking into a MASH unit. That's what it looks like, a mass casualty situation. It's like people all around you can hardly walk. They can hardly talk. They look like bipedal walrus. And it's so sad. I'm not saying this for effect. I'm not saying this to get links or hits. It's just saddening. And that's what the mall was once again. I mean, people there, every walk of life, it was the same thing. White people, black people, Hispanic people. It was vast majority, just as I described it. I went to, the next day I went to lunch with my mom, went to church with her and everything. Same thing. Went out to eat at a local restaurant, same situation. It was a MASH unit. And we got to talking and conversing a bit about it, and I was reflecting back on my childhood and how nauseating it is to go out in public now. I mean, let alone eat. I mean, eating out in public is hard to do. But I was reflecting back, and I'm not trying to demean people here, folks. That's not the point of this conversation. But when I was a boy, there were not very many obese people out there. That's what I was recounting to my mom. I granted we lived in a small community. But I sat there, I was literally counting on my hand as a boy. I was thinking, all right, when I was a little boy, there was this person, that person, and so forth. And I was going through, I think I named off five people, maybe six, of people that you would term as obese. We're not talking like, hey, I'm a little tubby, I should use 5 to 10 pounds. No. We're talking like, So, and I juxtaposed that to now. And I even qualified this. I said, you know, those six people that I classified as obese as a boy, I was thinking back and like, oh, okay, those people were 100 plus pounds overweight. Those people wouldn't even be like the people that we see now. Like, those people would just be considered like heavy. When I talk about this, I'm again not trying to be mean. I'm saying when you go out, there are people that are well over 100 pounds overweight. And it's sad. I'm not saying this to be disturbed. You know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to say this to hurt anyone's feelings. But it's sad. It's the food. It's the culture. It's the whole thing. It is the culture. It is the American culture. It is the death of a country. It is the death of a society. You reach this pinnacle of the height of hedonism, the height of everything. You get food anytime you want it, 24 hours a day. You want to go get ding-dongs and beef jerky? You got it. You want to go get 50 pounds of soda and just sit there and drink it and be a big blob? You can do it. All this is so accessible now. And it has contributed to where we are today. So it's the culture. That's all I can say. I gotcha. I know it's anthropological. You don't want me to go there, but it is. It's the culture. From top to bottom, stem to stern, gut to gullet, it's the culture that has created the MASH unit that I have to witness when I go out. It's the people that eat all those ho-hos, ding-dongs, and beef jerky and go, oh man, I'm a little overweight. Let me go to the doctor. And the doctor's going to readily prescribe you something that's going to kill you under the guise of, it's going to be all right. Or they'll say, well, now you can get gastric bypass. It's going to be all right. Sure, let's give you some some statin drugs because you've been eating so much garbage and you have such high cholesterol. And high cholesterol is not a problem. I want to go ahead and state that for the record. And that's just bollocks. But eating ho-hos and ding-dongs and beef jerky all day is. And sipping it down with a big 3-liter of soda. That's all problematic, right? I mean, all these are symptomatic of the culture. And the other big thing is this, the mainstream media, the movies, the TV shows, everything you see says it's all right. You know, to quote that old Huey Lewis song, who was actually a cover, but I love the Huey Lewis version myself. It's all right. Have a good time. It's all right. That's what the mass media tells you. That's what the TV shows tell you. That's what the movies tell you. That's what the cult of academia forces upon you. You can't say the F word. No, you can't say fat. Sure, it's a descriptive word that describes something. It's the inverse or contra of skinny. Gordo and flaco, see? But yeah, can't say it. It might offend someone. So you have to tolerate everything. You have to embrace it all. So you lose that that impetus for wanting to improve yourself. You lose that impetus of, hey, maybe I could get stronger. Maybe I could get healthier. No, it's all right. Have a good time. It's all right. Sure, you're 800 pounds. Sounds good. Embrace it. You got to accept it as beautiful. You have to accept it as normal. And if you don't, you're vilified. So this is the culture that has created the MASH unit. That's created this this ghastly zombie apocalypse that we live in. That I have to witness every time I leave the house. So I go to the mall, and there's that. And I was again talking about this with my mom and saying, you know, when I was a kid, I sound like an old person, I don't care. When I was a boy, you know, you went outside and you played, you maybe wore your play clothes. But if you went somewhere like the doctor or certainly a lawyer's office or a real estate office or just to go to the post office or any store, you would dress not up, not like you're going to church, but you would dress nicely. You might put on a collar shirt and maybe some khakis or some nicer jeans. In the Western MASH unit that is our current state, forget about it. It is bedlam out there. It's people in pajamas, in sweatpants, in flip-flops. It's people in bedroom slippers, curlers in your hair, a bunch of crap all over you. Who cares? Because you gotta what? Accept it. That's it. That's the caveat for it all. You can do anything you want. It is the height of relativism. It's the height of that Frankfurt school of do what thou wilt. That's it. I mean, that's where we are. And that is what has created this culture in such a short span of time. I mean, we're not talking 50 years here. It may have taken 50 years to get it there. But I'm only 41. So something happened in the very short span of life that I've lived on this big globe to get us here. I know what happened. I get it. I mean, we've been covering point after point of that. But it just really jars you, and it disgusts me personally to have to go out and witness this. Not because I'm being critical of these people. That's not what I'm trying to bring to the table. In contrast, I don't want humanity to go down this road. I don't want to go out to the mall and see bipedal walrus with sweatpants on, hanging off their behind with some sort of sick, you know, talking on their little, they got their little device. They were like a bunch of mentally handicapped people just doing this, like, this is it. Click, 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 click. That's all. That's what you see. And I'm not even talking to the people that have their pants below their crotch. What's up with this? I mean, how did we get here? I'm going to do a whole presentation one day about how I believe Americans and probably the rest of the Western society want to be slaves. But that's what I think of when I see people trying. They're not walking. They're sort of penguining around with their pants quite literally below their genitalia. I mean, it was dumb enough when people had their pants sort of below their waistline. And now the pants are below genitalia level. Again, I'm a very practical, pragmatic kind of guy. So when I see that, I think, man, do you not enjoy walking? Is that it? Like you want to just hobble around like you've been hobbled? I mean, Did you enjoy misery? That's what you wanted, that misery sort of hobbling effect? It's a lot to process, a lot to take in. But yeah, I'm watching. We all are, I guess. I'm just sort of putting it out there. I'm watching the death of Western society. It disgusts me. It makes me physically ill. I don't want to leave the house and have to interact with that. I don't want to have to come home from that experience and talk about it. I don't want to just have to sit in the car before I walk into a store and try to mentally psych myself up for the idiocy that I will have to be placed in. It's sad. But it's true. I mean, I'm just talking about the mall. You can fill in the blank of any of those big old box stores you want to go to. It's the same mess, man. It's the same thing. It's the same situation. And we should all be disgusted and appalled and driven to action, but we are not. That's the most disgusting thing of all. I mean, aside from the people who are being victimized, who are running headlong into the wood chipper, who are just shoving their head in the slaughterhouse bolt gun. I mean, aside from that, you have the flip side where it's where is the angst? Where's the outrage? Where are the people in the streets going, this is insane? And the answer is that they're all so well medicated with the pharmaceuticals and all the legalized drugs, brah, and all the TV and all the Netflix and all the device idiots doing this. They're so well medicated that they just don't get it. It's sad. It's kind of an odd point to bring up. I went to see this lady's talk and saw the movie. It was a lady called, she's still alive as far as I know, a lady named Temple Grandin, who basically was talking about how she had designed these sort of chutes for cattle and other, I think it was primarily cattle, but other animals to be slaughtered. But she designed it in a way that they would feel more comfortable and at ease as they went into the bolt gun. And I feel like that's exactly what all of these things in our current society are. It's all that nice little track you get to walk down. You're feeling good. Oh yeah, you're walking in a circle. No big deal. Hey, the chute's getting smaller. Now you're by yourself. That's no big deal. Hey, they're taking away my rights and civil liberties. That's no big deal. Hey, everything around me is watching me and listening to me. That's no big deal. I'm getting pharmaceuticals that are killing me. Who cares? I'm eating cancer food. I love it. I'm drinking GMO. Awesome. And, you know, before you know it, you are headlong into the harness and the bolt gun is against your brow. That's where we are, folks. We're about 2 minutes to midnight and nobody's even got a watch on. Let's get into the news a bit, shall we, before I continue to bore you with my thoughts. Here we go. This is actually from nomorefakenews.com. The site must be back up. The great investigative reporter John Rappaport. I got to reach out to this gentleman. On May 11th, 2019, WordPress suddenly took down my blog after 10 years of continuous operation. There was no warning or advanced notice of any kind. For the latest development, sign up for the newsletter. So that's how it is. You know, 1 minute your site's up, and in the case of John Rappaport, he actually had the audacity to criticize vaccines, and you know that's a no-no. I mean, it's a billion-dollar industry. You can't talk bad about it. Come on. And here today, gone tomorrow. I guess, luckily, the site is back up now. I don't have any more details on what actually happened. I'll look for that perhaps for the next episode of the program. Let's look into other items here. I'll reread this one because this was such a pain to pull this off the web. DailyMail.com. This is from Chris Dyer. Let me see. May 13th, 2019. This one is grim photos show filthy children as young as four toiling for up to 10 hours a day in mines, farms, and factories across the U.S. 100 years ago. Young children were forced to work as much as 10 hours a day down coal mines, in factories, on farms. Grueling hours and back-breaking work was the grim reality for many youngsters in the early 20th century. Growing up in the U.S. left little or no time for school or recreational activities as children were forced to work. Some children spent hours in the gloomy, dust-filled darkness, waiting to open trapdoors for mining cars. Wow. It's a whole photo montage here of these unfortunate children. And if you're watching, you're not watching this, guys. It's not on the screen. But if you're looking through this article, you'll notice something that's not quite there that you might be expecting. There's no black children there. So that should easily dispel this ludicrous myth of white privilege. I guess these kids didn't get the memo of the white privilege, huh? Because they're all Caucasoid in nature. They appear to be anyway. Oh, I guess they're not privileged after all, huh? Oh, it's not slavery, I guess, right? It's not slavery for those kids to be in mines and working in cotton mills and other factories. That's not slavery, right? Social justice warriors, because they're not the right protected class. Is that it? I'm just trying to get a clarification on this. Nonetheless, if you want to watch a really disturbing documentary that really chronicles this in North Carolina, while I was reading this, it reminded me of this 90s documentary called The Uprising of 34. And it's really just chronicles primarily North and South Carolina cotton mills in the late 18, early 1900s, and really just the advent of unions, of workers' rights, of an uprising in 1934. It's quite a ghastly tale, to be honest with you. But those people were primarily also not in a protected class, so this is all irrelevant. Just don't even worry about it. Let's move on. DailyMail.com.uk. Here we go. It says, by Daily Mail reporter. I've got a surprise for you. Husband blindfolds his wife and then chops off her fingers to stop her from studying for a degree. Wow, that's one way to do it, I guess. A jealous husband is facing life in prison after chopping off his wife's fingers because she began studying for a degree without his permission. Oh, my. Oh, boy, here we go. Rafiqul Islam, this is the gentleman's name, I suppose, and I'm using the term loosely. Rafiqul Islam, 30, blindfolded his wife, Hawa Akather, 21, and taped her mouth, telling her he was going to give her a surprise present. Instead, he made her hold out her hand and cut off all five fingers. One of his relatives then threw the fingers in the dustbin to ensure doctors could not reattach them. What a sick, sick piece of garbage this guy is. Mr. Islam, who was a migrant worker in the United Arab Emirates, had warned his wife there would be severe consequences if she did not give up her studies. After he came to Bangladesh, he wanted to have a discussion with me, the wife told the Times. Suddenly, he blindfolded me and tied my hands and taped my mouth. And oh, boy. Mr. Islam, huh? The attack is the latest in a series of acts targeting educated women in the Muslim majority company. Wow. Well, this should definitely have no effect on you. This has nothing to do with Islam. This has absolutely nothing to do with the loving religion of peace. Not at all. Mr. Islam. Oh, excuse me. Oh, hey, this is his real name, isn't it? Mr. Islam. You can't make this stuff up, folks. But bear in mind, this has nothing to do with Islam. This has nothing to do with the Muslim faith or the religion of peace or the tolerance and embracing that we should all be doing. It has nothing to do with that. No. I mean, this stuff happens all the time. And this is just a one-off incident. It has nothing to do with his faith. And I use that term so loosely, I can't hardly contain myself. Let's move back into the formerly great state of North Carolina. This is from FoxNews.com. Caleb Parquet is the author of this piece. And the title is, Liberal Student Arrested for Punching Pro-Lifer on UNC Campus. Triggered by images of aborted children. Trigger me not. Oh no, don't trigger me. Don't trigger me. I might punch in the face. Holy smokes, man. A liberal college student was arrested for assaulting a representative of the pro-life group Created Equal after she attacked him at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And it was caught on camera. Well, that's really the only reason anything actually happened to this person. Julian Ward, 19, a pro-choice feminist and aspiring journalist. Of course she is. And she'll fit in well, because that's kind of the state of journalism now. Said she was triggered by the graphic photographs depicting aborted children put up by Created Equal. The group uses the images to show the gruesome reality of abortion and to engage students in conversation about this human injustice. Well, you would think this would be something that the also-fun social justice warriors, this would be a position that they would just take the helm and just embrace the injustice of the unborn being gruesomely dismembered, sucked out, and killed. But it's not. It's not. Ward approached the group's display on April 2nd, asking them, did y'all put these up? Oh boy, you're supposed to cower in fear and run from the feminists and say, no, no, massa, we didn't put these up. Oh, please don't hit us in the face. When Austin Beagle confirmed that he did, she raced toward him with her fist flying. Beagle was allegedly punched in the face a number of times and was also hit in the stomach. Allegedly, I don't know how you can say that considering it's on video. You can see the link here if you're reading this article. Oh boy, when Austin Beagle confirmed, oh yeah, we got that. This is sick, man. There's more. You can read the article. It goes into this profanity-laced tirade by this giblet head. And it all boils down to, folks, is that no cause for violence, but eventually someone's got to stand up to this mob mentality of these communist trash subhuman idiots that keep assaulting people that don't agree with them. Eventually someone will have to stand up to this garbage. Stand up how, dear John, you might be asking? Well, I don't know. I can't answer that for you. You can get down on your knees and say, please, Master, don't hit me. Or you might have to get up and actually defend yourself in some form or fashion against attacks from this filth. I don't know what to say. What are you supposed to do when some crazed lunatic comes up and starts hitting you because you got a sign? I don't know. I don't get it. I do get it. I'm saying it again. I do get it. I get it, folks. I 100% get it. But at some point, you're going to have to stop this madness. You're at UNC, so it's a communist-run scum hole. The police there aren't going to help you. They're going to stand down, as they did with Silent Sam. So really, you have no recourse of action to do anything, I guess. I mean, you're either going to stand up for yourself or get down in the fetal position and cry for your safe space, I guess. I mean, that's the two choices you have. You know, the university's not going to help you. The police are not going to help you. You're either going to help yourselves or you're going to cower in fear and relegate yourself to the status that they want you to be in. No calls for violence. I'm calling for people to speak the truth. That's all. And not let themselves be beaten. I mean, it's just like the previous article where the lady got her fingers cut off. I mean, what are you supposed to do? under her religious doctrine, the right thing for her to do was nothing. Just sit there, I guess, and get your fingers cut off. Here in America, I think that's not really the thing you're supposed to do. When someone's beating you about the face, you need to try to stop that person from beating you about the face. Try to get away from that. I don't know what to say. If the police aren't going to help you, the school's not going to help you. In this incident, they arrested the woman, supposedly. I don't know. Maybe she'll get nothing like the folks that destroyed the statue and assaulted people on the UNC campus a few months back. What are you supposed to do? I mean, that's a good question here. I don't know what to tell you to do. I'm not going to say what I would do. I'm just going to pose the question, what do you do in a situation like that? Feel free to email me at john@anomicage.com. What do you do when you're being assaulted by scum? I don't know. My vote is sit there and take it and cry. That's what I would say. EpochTimes.com. Generic drug makers accused of price fixing by 44 states. May 12, 2019. Washington, a majority of the United States, filed a lawsuit that accuses 20 drug companies of orchestrating a sweeping scheme to inflate drug prices and stifle competition for generic drugs. State prosecutor said on May 11th, soaring drug prices from both branded and generic manufacturers have sparked outrage and investigations in the United States. The criticism has come from across the political spectrum, from President Donald Trump, a Republican, to progressive Democrats, including Senator Elizabeth Warren. You mean that Indian lady? No, just kidding. Who is running for president? So, I'll just stop it here. You can read the rest of the article. Should anyone be surprised that the medical mafia is putting the squeeze on you and hiking drug prices on branded and generics? Should that surprise anyone? I mean, what else would a medical mafia do? Well, the La Cosa Nostra would say, hey there, Bob, you got a nice little store. You should really get some fire insurance. And Bob says, I don't want any stinking fire insurance. So they burn down his store. And they come back the next day and say, hey, should have got some fire insurance. That's one angle of the medical mafia. And then the other angle is, hey, you got this fire insurance finally. That's a good move, huh? Good move. Well, you know we're going to have to increase your insurance by 5%. And Bob says, I don't want to increase my insurance. And the medical mafia says, remember what happened last time when your store accidentally burned down? Same stuff here. The medical mafia, through the doctors, gets you hooked on all this garbage. And then they say, well, now we got to raise the prices. What are you going to do, huh? Well, you're either going to go and buy street pharmaceuticals. You're either going to go to another country and try to get them at a cheaper rate. Or I guess you're going to die. Stark reality, but there it is, folks. I don't know what to say. Let's move on from ChristianNews.net. 11-year-old drag kid among faces of pride for Converse homosexual transgender shoe collection. Yes! Man, I'm glad this is coming out way before Christmas so I can get myself some tranny shoes and some homosexual shoes, because that's what I've been waiting for. I mean, shoes are shoes, you would think. Nay, nay. Converse is coming out with your own line, just in case you're gay or LMNOP or pedophile or whatever. I mean, that's all part of the new Converse collection. To I might add, well, that looks like that's one more company we should just not be doing business with. Because I have no apology in saying that I don't think Desmond the Amazing Child there as a trans kid is anything I want to be endorsing. I think that's the rollout for pedophilia. I think that's exactly what that is. And it's sick and disturbing. And I, for one, don't want to be walking around in shoes that support this blasphemous agenda of idiocy. But wait, there's more. I don't even have the article pulled up, but Coca-Cola, during Ramadan, for the great religion of peace that we all must bow down to. Just bow right now. Get on your knees. Get on your knees for Islam. Get on them. Or you're a racist. For Ramadan, Coca-Cola is going to have a special edition. Get ready. You can get the special crescent moon of Allah in your Coca-Cola can now. Isn't that rad? That's great. Get on your knees and keep bowing to Allah. And then when you get up, you can have some Coca-Cola with the special crescent moon in it. And then you can go to the mall and be around the dregs of society and get yourself some LGBT LMNOP trans shoes. Yeah. Show those off to your friends. Oh, yeah. Let's move on to some more fun. Wasting too much time here. Let me see. This is from freedomoutpost.com. George Orwell's 1984 is 70 years old. Our world looks an awful lot like the book, says John Vibes. I love the name, John. May 13th, 2019. This month, George Orwell's legendary novel 1984 turns 70 years old, and the warnings contained within the story are now more relevant than ever. Orwell's predictions were spot on, that it almost seems like it used to be some sort of accidental instruction manual for would-be tyrants. You're right, John. I tell you, speaking right out of my brain here. Oh, man, it just goes on to talk about the Orwellian doublespeak, which plays right into the adulteration of the language I've been talking about for quite a while now, and how the inverse of everything is actually now true. The telescreens, yeah, the telescreens are right here in your room. You could sleep with them. The tracking devices are in your phone. You gotta play with them as you walk around like some dolt and just sit here like a mindless goober playing with your little device. And if that's not enough, then the idiots will actually pay to have goodies like, I don't even know if I want to divulge the names of these lovely things. You know, the devices that play music, and all you got to do is hit that button and they'll say, "Hi there, John. You want to hear Ramones?" "Sure do." "Great." And they're listening to you the whole time, and they're tracking your every conversation and your every word, and they're listening to you when you're talking to your mom and when you're arguing with a toaster that won't let your bread out and everything else. It's all part of the plan, folks. It's all very 1984. Oh, boy. Yes, from old George Orwell or Eric Blair. Yeah, the book 1984 came out in 1948, in case you forgot the at-home version of the game and you missed it. And it was really about what was beginning to go on in that time period. And poor old Eric Blair just happened to die the same year it came out. It was a coincidence, though. There was nothing nefarious about his death. He just died. Sure, he had all kinds of connections to the elites in the UK. Sure, he served in India with all kinds of police specialties and so forth and so on. All a coincidence. It has nothing to do with the fact that old Eric Blair was spilling the beans on what was coming. And now it's no longer a coming. It's a here. Let's go. Oh boy, what do we got here? Voiceofeurope.com. Nationalist Christian Hungary is thriving. Rising marriage rates, falling abortion, and highest birth rates in 20 years. What a racist scumhole Hungary is. If there's one place we don't want to be like or ever visit, it's apparently Hungary. Whew, what a bunch of malarkey this is. Oh, who's this by? I can't see. Emma R. from the 1st of May, 2019. Marriage is up by 43% since 2010, while divorce has dropped by 22.5% in that same period. The demographic turn around has not been an accident. Well, it sounds like a conspiracy theory. But the fruit of the deliberate programs to promote... Holy cow! I don't think we can say this on the air. To promote... Let me whisper it. Marriage. You're talking about marriage here. Marriage. And the family. While defending Hungary's cultural identity and Christian roots. I hope they didn't hear that. I hope Siri didn't hear me. I hope that Google box in there didn't hear me. I think we're in trouble. So, they were promoting marriage and the family while defending Hungary's cultural identity and Christian roots. These people need to be brought to heel. It's like Hillary Clinton said about the black population when her husband passed the bill in the 90s there. The omnibus crime bill. These people need to be brought to heel. We can't have this kind of craziness. We need to be embracing diversity. We need to be loving Islam to death. We need to all be kneeling before Allah. We need to all just be being trans. Don't be married. Don't have kids. Just be... be what the globalists want you to be. Hungary is obviously not where you need to move, patriots. I mean, if there's one model that the U.S. does not need to mimic, it's what's going on in Hungary. These people are sick. Here we go. Speaking of sick, this is coming from NBC News. Oh, it's coming out of pop culture. Oh, boy. Let's see if we got an author on this piece. This is from May 14th, 2019. Huh. Oh, here we go. Gwen Aviles. And the title of this piece is Author, Character, and Mr. Rathburn Comes Out as Gay, Gets Married in Season Premiere. The episode entitled Mr. Rathburn and the Special Someone starred lesbian actor Jane Lynch as a special guest and aired Monday on PBS. Well, this sounds good. Mr. Rathburn from the children's show. Let me underscore this for those of you who missed that or just thought I was speaking out of my mind here. Mr. Rathburn from the children's show author got married to another man in the show's 22nd season premiere, spurring effusive reactions from those who grew up watching the program. The episode titled Mr. Rathburn and the Special Someone starred lesbian actor Jane Lynch. Yeah, we got that. Oh, boy. I don't even need to read any more, I don't think. This is beyond sick. It's just... it's part of what you already know that it is, folks. It's the LGBT, LMNOP, and now pedophilia, too. Right, NAMBLA? If you don't know what NAMBLA's about, you should look into it, folks. NAMBLA. North American Boy Love Association. Yeah. So they're pushing this garbage in a kid's show. This is a cartoon program for children. For children. For children. This isn't Beavis and Butthead. This is not King of the Hill. This is not The Simpsons. This isn't any of that. This is a kid's show. It's a children's show. And again, I have to think back to my own childhood, and I was thinking about toys and playing out in the yard and playing army with my friends and watching G.I. Joe and Transformers and Scooby-Doo and that sort of stuff. And ironically, this whole gay thing just never came up. I know that's really sexist and homophobic and racist and transphobic and transspeciesophobic and just all in all terrible. But it never came up. And now... you're going to be bombarded with it at every turn. And if you don't embrace it, you know what that means. Yeah. It's sad, folks. It's exactly what I talked about in the beginning. It is the death of Western society. It is the global mass unit. It is all that stuff and more. And the best part is, we're all sitting back and watching it like it's the folks in the Civil War that would get out on the field and just watch the violence go down. That's what we're doing. We are spectator sporting the downfall of Western society. So as I say oftentimes, feel free to stand up. Anytime. Anytime would be great. Violence? Never. Not unless someone enacts violence upon you. Never. Okay? That's what they want. They want to victimize themselves. They want to become the frail little sheep that's getting beat upon by those evil racists, conservatives. So don't do that. Don't be a boob and play into their game. Violence is stupid. Defensive violence is sometimes a must, but don't let yourself get beat about the face and don't go about beating someone else in the face. You know what I'm saying? But you should be standing up. There should be millions of people in every street, in every big city, saying enough. This is bollocks. But there's not. So that's all I got for right now. I can't keep beating this dead horse. The horse is dead enough. We got a great guest today, Mr. Alan Myers, forensic accountant, in a mere matter of moments. We will talk with him. See you in a second. It is my distinct honor and privilege to welcome Mr. Alan Myers to the program today. Alan is a certified public accountant in San Diego and a forensic accountant. As a CPA, he has accumulated 29 years of experience in providing accounting, tax, and litigation support for bankruptcy trustees and civil litigators. He has analyzed the financial condition and financial affairs of bankruptcy debtors and parties in litigation. For 8 years, he has researched, studied, and analyzed the Federal Reserve System, banking, and the national debt. He is a writer, speaker, and radio commentator on these and other related topics. The national monetary system is the most powerful system because everything in our country is connected to it. Unfortunately, the monetary system does not work in favor of the citizens. Alan brings detailed information regarding the problems created by the system and a simple, doable call to action. Thank you so much, Alan, for being on the program.
John, it's a pleasure and an honor. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad we're finally talking on the program. We've talked a little bit back and forth. It's great to finally get you on.
Oh, thank you. I look forward to what we're going to talk about today.
Well, it's going to be great. We're going to have you on for several sort of more condensed episodes here for a few weeks. And it's really all to talk about your awesome piece of work. I don't know how else to describe it here. We got Fed Ed. It's not a full book, I wouldn't say, but it's a great, you know, bigger than a pamphlet, not quite a novel, awesome primer on all things Fed. And when I first read it, I was blown away. Just because at the ease, you could really connect all these dots. And it was sort of an everyman's journal to understand our monetary system, how the Federal Reserve really threw an intentional monkey wrench into that. And what is money? What are banks? I mean, all these sort of things, I think, are a lot of topics and terms that people think they know. And they sort of throw out in the lexicon of conversation like they know what's going on. And then you pin them down and ask them, well, what the heck is money? And they're like, well, it's this stuff. We don't even use green things anymore or metal circles. We use these weird ones and zeros that are attached to some plastic card that could get turned off at any moment. So anyway, I love what you put together here, and I hope more people will get into it. So we'll get into a little bit of that today and in the coming weeks.
Super. Thank you.
Well, I hate to say we got to start at the beginning, but a little bit, just a little bit about yourself and sort of what led you on this journey. I mean, CPA and forensic accountant, those are pretty awesome titles. What made you write this Fed Ed piece here?
What happened is that this has been about an eight-year process. And prior to that, I would say I was totally asleep. I didn't think much about my country. I didn't think much about the economy other than what was generally out there, because what I found, what I finally discovered, never included in my college education or post-college. First, and I cannot tell you where on the pages of that book I woke up, but it's within that book I woke up. Mm-hmm. That led me to other books, documentaries, on and on. And each year I would go through this process and I would think, this is stuff I never learned in school. This is information none of my professional friends know about. But I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it. I just got it because I wanted to condense this information down into something that the regular person could read and understand and get. And that's what Fed Ed is. It's just something that I finally realized, this really needs to be talked about. This really needs to be understood by everybody in this country. When I give presentations, I will tell people that I know there are many, many serious problems in this country, and I don't dismiss them or minimize them. They're out there, but they're very divisive, and I don't know if that's by design or not. Hmm. The Fed, the monetary system of this country, is basically an all-inclusive problem. We are practically all hurt by this system, yet what it does, how it does it, the end results, we take as normal every day. No problem. What I did with Fed Ed is to take everything that I learned over an eight-year period and condense it down in what I call modules. A module, at least the first 15 modules are each one page long, step by step. Because when you go ask somebody about money, other than thinking about how much they have in their wallet, this is not something that's ever discussed. And that's why module one starts out as the origin and development of money. But that's how I got through. That's how I got to where I am. It was in the beginning, it was very, very accidental, and now it's very deliberate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one thing I kept thinking about while I was reading it is, I never learned any of this in school. How does the common high school graduate not know this? So, you know, most American people don't have any clue of what's in there.
I totally agree with you. I would say that what's in Fed Ed is something that is very accessible, very understandable for, let's say, high school students, juniors or seniors. This is not in the, in fact, the amount of, I'd use the term financial literacy in this country is actually very limited. It's not presented in high school where it really needs to be, along with the fact that civics education has been taken out.
Yeah, it's so unfortunate. I remember 15 or 20 years ago, they had all this this legislation about credit cards because they were giving credit cards to, you know, barely 18-year-olds, and they were having all these problems. And I was thinking, well, they probably wouldn't have these problems if they had any sort of knowledge of what money was or how spending and loans worked and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Anyway, shall we begin with the origin and development of money?
Yeah, that would be perfect. Thank you.
Money has a lot of different connotations. A lot of people think about money being a physical object, whatever. But at the beginning, and this is going way, way back, you go way, way back, and people were doing what I call direct barter. Apples for oranges, eggs for tomatoes. As time went on, people found out that direct barter was actually very time consuming. It's not easy. I want eggs and, you know, you want tomatoes, but I don't have any tomatoes. So I got to go elsewhere. Well, finally, people over time, especially as I believe as trade expanded over wider and wider areas, they came up with what I call a generally accepted item of barter, depending on the time, depending on the locale, because money at its heart facilitates an indirect transaction. It makes it happen. And if something facilitates the indirect transaction, it's money. I don't care what it is. That is its key asset or its key characteristic. Also thinking back in time, it was people that got this done. People came up with the idea. People developed the idea. People used the idea. Not banks, not governments, people. Which tells me that money is something that came from the people. And the benefits that come from money creation truly belong to the people of a country, not to its banks, not to its government. Therein lies one of the big problems of our current monetary system. The other thing that really happened out of this development of and use of money as an indirect transaction facilitator is that people were now able to become more and more specialist. If I can get whatever I need because I have money, well, I don't have to make or grow everything I've got, which allowed people, again, over a great amount of time, to become more and more specialized, which means they got better at what they were doing. And society, from that standpoint, grew and developed. How did we get trade routes going all over the world? It's because people could use some form of money. Ultimately, though, the takeaway on this is that it's people, not banks or governments, that created and developed money, which means money really belongs to the people, and especially the benefit that comes from money creation. Does that make sense?
Perfectly. Absolutely right. Because, I mean, once you get that craft specialization going on, then you can see, the rise of brick masons, the rise of metallurgy, the rise of all that great state-level society stuff that we all take for granted today. It all didn't just happen. I like it.
Yeah. And that came from the use of money, which is the indirect transaction facilitator. Before we leave this, I want to throw in one quote. All of my modules begin with a quote, and I try to find ones that I think are really applicable to the topic at hand. And this one, it's in module one. The quote's relatively short. It, which means money, is the most important subject intellectual persons can investigate and reflect upon. It is so important that our present civilization may collapse unless it is widely understood and its defects remedied very soon. This was by Robert H. Hemphill, credit manager, Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, 1936. We're talking in the heart of the Great Depression. This is somebody very connected, very in the system, and he is stating that money is the most important subject intellectual persons can investigate and reflect upon. And that is exactly the path that we're now taking today. I love it.
I do too. That's true. Yeah, I love those quotes that you have sort of peppered into every module. Those are great.
Thank you. The next module is historical characteristics of money. The quote that opens this is, money is worth what it will help you to produce or buy and no more. Henry Ford. I wanted to deal with historical characteristics of money because this understanding the characteristics or attributes of what makes something, its ultimate use and benefit is it facilitates indirect transactions. What is chosen as money by a society at any particular time and different characteristics or attributes. Mm-hmm. The character, and remember, this is going way back in a time when we had no technology. We had no electricity. We had no banks. The characteristics are transportable, dividable, meaning the more pieces you can put it into, the more you have to trade. None won't be any good. Needs to be wanted wherever you're taking it. Scarce and supply helps. Interchangeable. In today's market, in today's monetary system, if I owe you a nickel, you'll take any nickel I have. You don't care which one it is. That's interchangeable. Unit of account. That means goods and services are priced in the monetary unit that's being used.
Mm-hmm.
Store of value. Store of value is that yesterday's dollar buys the same as today's, will buy the same as tomorrow. That would be great if we had it in our monetary system. We don't.
That's what I was thinking.
Another characteristic, which is relatively new, given the talking about legal tender status. The next one to me is absolutely fundamentally important, especially in today. It has a physical counterpart. And finally, ease of use. The thing about physical counterpart, a lot of people, tremendous amount of our money is electronic digits, and I don't have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got countries such as Norway, Sweden, Denmark that are pushing really, really hard to go completely cashless. And I talk about this in one of the modules, but just to say that if all your money is electronic digits in some bank's computer, keep in mind, you have no direct access to the computer. You don't know where the computer is. You're completely dependent on electricity, internet access, computer access. This, to me, is a tremendous weakness.
Yeah, that's very
problematic. And if any one of those... If somebody doesn't like you and you get shut out of your account, you have money.
Money, at its heart, does one thing and one thing only. Its ultimate use and benefit is to facilitate an indirect transaction. We've discussed a lot of the characteristics that over time have helped define what would be used as money. And ultimately, the more an item possesses these characteristics, the more likely it would be used and would become a successful form of money. Regardless of what it is, regardless of the number of characteristics, it facilitates an indirect transaction. If it gets that job done, it is money. Only in, let's say, in the last 50, 60 years that we really had to worry about having a physical counterpart. The countries Norway, Sweden, and Denmark have worked tirelessly and very hard to come cashless. To me, this is absolutely dangerous because when all your money is electronic digits in a computer that you have no access to, you don't even know where it is, your access can be shut down, you're totally dependent on the electrical grid, internet access, and computers, gee, what could go wrong? Without a physical counterpart, monetary system is very, very weak and fragile. The next stop in Module 3 is to talk about, we've just spoken about characteristics of money. Let's talk about what has been used as money in the past. And the quote I have for this one is, "It is incumbent on every generation to pay its own debts as it goes. A principle which, if acted on, would save one half the wars of the world." Thomas Jefferson. Just another idea of how important it is to understand money and being able to pay your own way. Now, I broke money into four general categories: animals, consumables, couture, and metals. Animals would be actually animals or their pelts or fur. That has been used as money. Consumables. corn, spices, tobacco, whiskey, of course, whiskey. When I say couture, beads, anklets, clamshells, gemstones, silk, something, and then metals. Metals including not just gold and silver, but bronze, copper, iron. These are, and I'm talking about just the raw metal, hunks of it. This is what has been used in the past as money, as an indirect transaction facilitator. One interesting part about this is that the Incas, a well-known civilization who did extremely well for hundreds of years, and they literally had tons of gold and silver. In fact, they referred to gold, the term they used translated as sweat of the sun, and the term used for silver is translated into tears of the moon. I believe that the Incas held these metals in such high esteem, and pun intended, they would not use these metals by using them as money. The Incas built the civilization they did by using cacao beans as money. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, that's
simple,
great.
Simple cacao beans worked as their form of money. And there's been all kinds of other crazy types of money in the world. But the takeaway is that if it helps to facilitate a transfer of ownership of a good or a service from one person to another, that item is money. Any thoughts, John?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty clear cut right there.
Okay.
I sort of bemoan that everything's going cashless now. I know I should be that guy that's using cash more often, but I'm just as bad as everybody else when I'm at the store and it's like $5 in my wallet and I got to buy $20 worth of groceries. I'm going to use the debit card and all that stuff. But
I have no problem with the use of credit, use of debit cards, checks. I have no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
My thing is that if all your monetary wealth is somehow, some way, an electronic digit in a computer that you have no control or access of, you are completely and totally dependent. And one of the pushes for this is that there are people out there pushing for this cashless society. I'll just go off topic for a minute. Because they consider people who actually keep some cash on hand for an emergency. Well, if you're doing that, you have it in excess of what you need on a daily basis. Well, you're a hoarder.
Yeah.
Okay. This is craziness. You have a little extra food. You have a little extra water. You don't drive your car until it gets to empty. You know, it's a way of taking care of yourself and being able to help yourself and your friends and your neighbors and your family and not being utterly, totally dependent on a system that will fail.
Yeah, I mean, I see that as just common sense, self-reliance. That's just what you should do to make sure you're covering your bases, so to speak.
Well, when you are self-reliant as much as you can be in this society, not only does that mean you take less, but you can give more.
Mm-hmm.
When you are capable of taking care of yourself, you are actually in a better position to help others. And isn't that part of the human story, helping others?
That's it.
For me, it is. The next module is module 4, and the term M1 money. Now, a lot of people know the term M1, and they may be thinking of a tank or a rifle, but I'm thinking of money. M stands for money. 1 stands for the number 1 supply. This is an economic monetary system term. I didn't make it up. To get into this topic, I want to read a quote, very short. The process by which banks create money is so simple that the mind is repelled. John K. Galbraith, 1975, from his book, Money, Whence It Came, Where It Went. Very famous economist. Actually, for me, the process by which banks create money is so simple, it does not repel my mind, it attracts my mind. And it becomes very illuminating when you understand this, which we will eventually get into. But first, what is money? What is M1 money? M1 money is the supply of money in our system that is considered on-demand, spendable now. It has four components. The four components, and this is all in-country, in circulation. In-country meaning being in the U.S. and not somewhere else. First, we have cash. That's that paper stuff. Keep in mind that we call it paper, but it's really not wood pulp paper. 75% cotton, 25% linen. You got cash in country in circulation. You got coin in country in circulation. You have all the electronic digits in all the checking accounts, not savings. And traveler's checks issued by non-banks. Traveler's checks issued by non-banks is such a small amount, such a small percentage, let's just put it aside, and we'll deal with the big three, cash, coin, and electronic digits. Keep in mind that this definition has come from the Federal Reserve itself. Cash in circulation. Cash in circulation is the physical paper money that you have, I have, our businesses have. That's in-country in circulation. Same with the coin. Electronic digits, as I said. Electronic digits are in your checking account, my checking account, not savings. Savings accounts is considered M2 because it's ultimately not considered to be spendable on demand. That's the M1 money supply. That's the money supply that is spendable now. The interesting thing about this is that people will know that, and actually that in when we get to the Module 5, just because what you hold in your pocket and I hold in my pocket, cash and coin, is money, M1 money, doesn't mean that when it's held by a bank or the U.S. government or the Fed itself, that it's money, because it's not. Going back to Module 1, who created the concept, developed the concept of money? People did. In our monetary system today, only people and our businesses actually hold, use, and spend money. The Fed, no money in its own name. The federal government has no money in its own name. And banks have no money in their own name. This is not me making this up. This is by their own definition. Does that make sense so far?
Absolutely. I think that's a lot for people to wrap their brain around because they think, oh, when I take my check and take it to the bank and deposit it, like you're saying, it then becomes no longer M1 money. It becomes part of the banks, right?
Well, what happens? Okay.
I don't want to skip ahead too much, but I was thinking.
Yeah. Let's go through this, and then in the process, we'll deal with Module 5.
Sure.
Okay. How many times have you heard somebody say, somebody, the Fed, the U.S. government, whatever, is printing too much money?
Mm-hmm.
Heard all the time. Well, money in our system, and just know that I'm always talking about our monetary system, money in our system is never, ever printed into existence. Yes, the dollar bill is printed. It's printed by the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, which is the Bureau of the U.S. Treasury. It is an entity in the Fed called the Cash Products Office that actually places the order with the Bureau for the Federal Reserve notes to be printed. The Federal Reserve, the Bureau prints them up for the Fed, and sitting on the loading box of the Bureau waiting for a Fed's or truck to come pick it up, you could have millions and millions of street value dollars sitting there waiting. To the Bureau, all that is just a print job. Now, back some years ago, the charge per note was 6.4 cents a note, regardless of denomination. Now, each denomination has a different cost per note, but round numbers, let's say it's 10 cents a note.
Mm-hmm.
So to the Bureau, that prints the Federal Reserve notes, it's just a print job. It'd be like you going to your local printer wanting flyers, and you go get them, and the flyers are sitting on the counter, and to the printer, it's just a print job. It's not money. It's just a print job. The Fed picks it up. Armor truck. Take it back to the bank. The big steel doors open. The armor truck drives in, shuts off its engine. The steel doors drop down. Everything, truck and all, gets dropped down into the basement to be unloaded. In the vault of the Fed, you can have billions and billions of street value dollars sitting there. And they have incredible security there. Armed guards, fantastic security, huge, huge doors. To the Fed, all that paper with green ink, to the Fed, it's nothing but a print job. It gets the same bookkeeping treatment as office supplies, postage, repair and maintenance. It's nothing but an operating expense. It is not money. It is not reserves. It literally is just paper with green ink to the Fed. The next stop, it goes to a bank. Now, for a bank to be able to get these Federal Reserve notes, the bank has to give up electronic reserves. Now, keep in mind, banks have no money. They only have reserves, physical and electronic. So let's say I'm the Fed, and you're the Bank of John, and you call me up and you tell me, you know, you want your regular order. I send you all the paper with green ink, and you know what I'm going to do. I'm going to reduce your reserve account at the Fed. When you get it, you're going to reduce your Fed reserve account, the electronics, and you're going to increase your physical reserves on your bookkeeping. So to you, the Bank of John, all that paper with green ink in your vault and teller drawers, it's not money. It's reserves in physical form. That's all it is. And reserves and money are two separate, distinct, in essence, currencies that exist in our system. Banks have reserves. The federal government has reserves. People will never have a reserve, and banks and the U.S. government will never have money. They're two separate currencies. Next stop, I go to the Bank of John, I go to the ATM, and I'm going to get $100 out of the ATM. In the moment that 520s comes out of the ATM, my personal money supply has not changed in amount. It's only changed in form. My physical money, my cash, has now gone up 100. My electronic digits has gone down. But my total money supply has not changed. In our monetary system, physical money, cash and coin, is only money when people in our businesses have it. Not the banks, not the government. Does that make sense so far?
Absolutely. I just want to underscore that point that you just mentioned because it keeps resonating in my brain. So the American people, since we're just talking America here, will never have reserves. All they're going to have is M1 money. And the Fed,
correct,
and all the banks you see on the side of the road and the ATMs and all that jazz, they're never going to have real money. They're just going to have reserves.
Correct.
All right. I just want people to wrap their brain around that because I know some people are going, but wait, they have money. I get this green stuff.
Well, I would put it this way. I laid out the four steps that the Federal Reserve note has to go through before it becomes M1.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is that if I go to the Bank of John and I decide to deposit some cash, well, my M1 money supply will not change. It's still going to be the same. It's just changing form.
Gotcha.
Cash is going to be less, and my electronic digits is going to go up. For you, the Bank of John, well, your reserves just went up. But it's not money. Now, the one of the more interesting things that I found out in my study is that, okay, people have money. Banks and the U.S. government have reserves. What does the Fed have? Well, the Fed has neither. It has neither money nor reserves in its own name. And somebody's going to say, come on, Alan, there's no way. You're a whack. How can the Fed operate without any money or any reserves? And I'll explain. Oh, by the way, the authority that I got on this is from our dear friend Ben Bernanke. He confirmed it in 2012. Anyway, for those who are old enough to remember Star Trek, The Next Generation, great TV show, and the captain of the Enterprise, Captain Picard, he'd be in his ready room, and he'd go up to a replicator. Now, a replicator looks like a microwave oven built into a wall without a front door. He'd go up to it, and he'd say, computer, P, Earl Grey, hot. And then you'd hear, and there in the replicator would be the cup, the saucer, the tea bag, heated to perfection. But when you have a food and beverage replicator, do you have any need for a refrigerator, freezer, stove, oven, microwave, food, pantry, dishes? Of course not, because you got a replicator.
That's it.
Well, the Fed's got a replicator. Creates reserves. The Fed acquires all assets and satisfies all expenses by creating reserves.
Okay, so the Fed doesn't actually have a reserve. They just create this mystical reserve. I got you.
The support of this is that in March of 2012, Ben Bernanke, I believe he was the chairman of the Board of Governors at that time, gave a four-part lecture to the students at the George Washington University School of Business. It was a 4 1-hour lectures. And I got to tell you that when I first, now I got the videos, the 1 hour videos, and I also found the transcripts for everything he said. And I thought, oh, this is fantastic. I don't have to take notes. I can highlight as he speaks. Well, I queued up the first hour, and I got to tell you, before I hit play, I was really nervous. I thought this guy was going to explain the world to me, kick my khaki, and I'm just going to have to shut up and go home. Well, didn't turn out that way. Move forward to the fourth lecture. And in the fourth lecture, he's talking about what the Fed did post-2008 to help the economy. You might remember we had a little problem post-2008. He goes on to describe that the Fed went out into the marketplace. Keep in mind, the Fed, when I say the Fed, I mean the Federal Reserve System, the Federal Reserve Banks. The Fed cannot directly deal with the U.S. government. Verboten. Cannot do it. The Fed goes out into the marketplace and acquires $2 trillion worth of treasuries. And a little bit later, I can explain trillion. $2 trillion worth of interest, real-life interest-bearing treasuries of the U.S. government. And he goes on to, and for this example, I'll be the Fed, and John, you'll be the Bank of John.
All right.
And you come into my office, because you know I'm looking for treasuries, and you dump a bunch of paper on my desk, and I look at you, you look at me. Yeah, cool. I go over to my computer. I hit the keys a few times. I hit return. I come back. I give you a thumbs up. You give me a thumbs up, and you walk out. You know what I just did. I know what I just did. I'll explain it. As the Fed, in acquiring these treasuries, real-life interest-bearing debt obligations of the U.S. government, all I have to do is make one journal entry into my accounting records. I debit or increase the asset U.S. treasuries, and I credit the reserve account, which increases the balance, the reserve account of the Bank of John, hit enter. I, the Fed, create reserves, and I get anything I want. That is how the Fed acquires assets and satisfies expenses. It has a replicator. It creates reserves on demand. It never spends money. Now, there's a document out there called the Financial Accounting Manual. The Financial Accounting Manual is a couple hundred pages long. It is the Financial Accounting Manual of the Federal Reserve System. In it is a very, very detailed chart of accounts. For those who don't know, a chart of accounts is a list of all the accounts that are in the Fed's general ledger, their accounting system. And it goes in order of assets, liabilities, equity, income, and expenses. The assets are always listed in terms of liquidity. And the first assets that are listed typically are cash on hand, cash in a bank, right?
All right.
Okay, remember, this is the chart of accounts. This is all the accounts that are would be active in the general ledger of a Fed bank. The first asset in the financial accounting manual is gold certificates, which are receivable. This is another way of saying that no Fed bank in its own name has even one bank account. It doesn't have a bank account because it doesn't need a bank account. It doesn't need one because it would never use one.
Gotcha.
It creates reserves. If the Fed actually wrote a check, well, it's not actually on a live bank account because it doesn't have a bank account. They would wait for it to come through, and then they would just simply credit the bank that's submitting it their reserve account. The Fed creates reserves. It can extinguish reserves, but it has no money and it has no reserves because it doesn't need them because it will never use them. That's your Federal Reserve banks.
That's pretty heavy right there. It has no money, it has no bank account, and it literally creates reserves.
Right, and it gets everything it wants by doing that.
Hmm.
Not bad, huh?
That's pretty crazy. I like your example with the food, you know, that you could just replicate. I mean, yeah, I mean, it has no need for a bank account or any of this M1 money because it can just hit the old start button on the replicator.
Back in the day, it was pencil on paper. Nowadays, it's fingertips on a keyboard, hit enter. So when people say that the Fed injected money into the system, that is incorrect. And the Fed actually does not, it does not create money, it does not spend money, it does not have money, and it doesn't, in essence, it doesn't have any reserves, because it creates them.
Yeah.
And therefore, if someone says, oh, the Fed is spending taxpayers' money, no, it's not. Simply creates reserves.
It creates reserves.
That's all it does. And it gets any asset and satisfies any expense. And we have Ben Bernanke to thank for confirming that. Because that's what he's, you know, that's what he basically described in the fourth lecture was a journal entry. Which is pretty nice, huh?
That's pretty heavy stuff right there. It took me a minute to wrap my brain around this as I was reading it because I was sitting there going, well, what about all these stinking little reserve banks all over the country? Like, is this, I kind of viewed it as some bizarre, like a magician's trick. You know, you've got the box, you've got the handkerchief and the wand, but all that's really just to show, like, the real action's going on in a little compartment underneath the table, you know?
Well, the real action in our monetary system from the money standpoint is in banks. Now, the Fed can set policy. It can set interest rate. It can set reserve requirement. It can do this stuff. But that has no direct impact on money creation. Only banks create money. Not the Fed, not the U.S. government. They can, you know, encourage more money creation. They can forestall more money creation. But this is just an influence. It's not direct hands on the levers.
Yeah.
That's with banks.
Wow.
How's that for something new?
That's a lot of good stuff. So you got the magician and the magician's assistant. I guess the Fed and the bank are the ones pulling the...
Well, the banks are... The Fed creates the system.
Mm-hmm.
The Fed influences the system, but ultimately, and this is what we'll get into next time, which is who and how is our M1 money supply created? And as I said, M1 money is never, ever printed into existence. The printed paper becomes M1 and can stop being M1, but at the moment it's printed, it's not money.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a print job. And then it becomes a printing expense. And then it becomes a physical reserve. And then it becomes money. And my little analogy is, let's say you and I are lumberjack buddies, and you come over, and I got a couple of trees on the ground, and you look and say, hey, Alan, nice job. And I look at you and go, John, what do you think of that furniture?
Yeah.
You're thinking, oh, no. Those trees hit Alan in the head again. Alan, that's not furniture. That's just cut trees. Yeah, but one day it's going to be furniture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but right now it's just cut trees. Well, when the Bureau of Engraving and Printing prints those Federal Reserve notes, yeah, one day it's going to be money. But at that moment, it's just a print job. It's just trees on the ground.
This might be me thinking too much, but who actually pays for the print job at the Bureau of Engraving? Is that us?
What happens is, remember, we're talking the purchaser of this print job is the Fed.
Gotcha. Okay.
Okay. You're the Bureau/U.S. Treasury. I'm the Fed. I get an invoice.
Just like you ordered some thumbtacks or some staplers, yeah.
So what I do is I go into my accounting system and I put a debit into printing expense, and the offsetting and equal credit goes to the U.S. Treasury's reserve account. I hit enter. I'm done.
Jeez.
That's the way it works.
God grief. Oh,
and
man.
We got Ben Bernanke to thank for confirming this is how it actually does. Because in his description of what he said, he talked about that the Fed gets the treasuries, and you know, the way it, and this is his word, not mine, the way it pays for it is it increases the reserve account of the bank they acquired the treasuries from. That's a credit entry.
Okay.
To me, the Fed pays for nothing. When you and I go to the store or something, we pay for stuff because we go out of pocket. When you get to create reserves, you're not paying for anything. You're acquiring assets, you're satisfying expenses, but you pay for nothing.
Good grief.
That's it.
That's insane.
Any questions?
So I'm guessing it works the same way with all the employees of the Federal Reserve. They're also getting paid out of this magical reserve credit system, right?
Well, the Fed employees, what would happen, you know, especially in the now in the day of electronic transfers,
mm-hmm.
and this kind of also happens at the bank level, but at the Fed, okay, I'm the Fed, you're an employee of the Fed.
Okay.
By the way, John, you're a really good employee. Well,
oh,
thank
great.
You. And it's payday. So what am I going to do? Well, it's simple. I'm going to go over to my keyboard. I'm going to post a journal entry. I'm going to debit this is the short version of it. It can be a little longer, but the upshot
sure.
is I am going to debit wage expense for your net wage, and I'm going to credit through your bank. You're going to get a credit in your checking account. Hit enter. We're done. What I actually did is I created a reserve for your bank, and their offsetting entry is to increase your checking account. The bottom line is this entire banking system, the way it really, really functions, comes down to bookkeeping. That is how simple it really is, bookkeeping. Don't need a PhD in economics. Don't need to be a Wall Streeter. You need to be a bookkeeper. And you can understand the monetary system.
Man, that's so insane.
What's interesting and or sickening to me is that it is this simple, if this is uncommon knowledge?
That's what I was just thinking. I was thinking, man, if I go to the bank right now up the street and talk to them about this, they're going to think I'm nuts.
Well, this is my suggestion to you and your listeners is to get a sense of what we're talking about and what we will continue to talk about. One of the first things when I finally got deep into this and I really started bothering my friends is I would ask them one question. What do you know about the Fed? Now, most of my friends are professionals, highly educated, really nice people. They know zip. Nothing. You ask go ask your CPA. Go ask your financial advisor. What do you know about the Fed? Tell me what you know. Chances are you'll get a nervous laugh and, 10, 20 seconds of something, and that's it. Somebody asked me, what do I know about the Fed? Sit down, relax.
Yeah.
You got 2 hours?
How much do you really want to know?
Right.
The short version or the
Again,
full?
This is all basic, simple information. It's not highly technical. It's just not out there in our educational system. And, what you're doing with this program is helping people get the information they need to really understand how this system works, and ultimately, as we go through the episodes, how it's really working against each one of us, what we have to do to change, the call to action, and what we're going to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, we got a lot more to go, but I think this has been a great start.
So do I. I mean, I really hope that people grasp this and really start to get all the eccentricities of how money works, how the Fed works, how the bank works, all the way down to you getting that magical paycheck that you don't even really have to cash anymore. It just automatically appears.
Right. And again, I'm fine with electronic digit money. I really am. It makes things happen. And it facilitates an indirect transaction, so it's real money. It's just that I don't want all my money to be electronic digits. I want physical. But the biggest thing, and which we'll get to later, is the power to create money must be returned to the benefit of the people.
That's it.
And once we get that done, and we can get it done. And people might say, oh, we can't do this, we can't do that, no. The woe is me. And I'll tell you, I keep reflecting back on this. I reflect back on the Declaration of Independence. Think about it. It's 1776. Britain is already in country.
That's it.
Britain is the most powerful military force on the planet. And it thinks it owns you. And you get together with you and 55 others, and you put your name on a document, and you tell Britain and the King of England, bite me. We're going our own way. We can get this done. We need to get this done. And on that, okay, there's 56 signatures on the Declaration of Independence. If you saw a list of all 56, most of us only would know 5 of them. 56 guys put it all on the line for a dream. We don't even know their name.
Yeah, that's what's so sad. I kind of look at all the happenings every day and disgust and think, and then the people stood up, and then the next day happens. And then, kind of just keeps going down the line, and I think, wow, they throw all that tea in the harbor, and then the British came and started, setting up quarters in people's homes and taking people off the street and taking their weapons. And
every one of those, I believe every one of the original 10 amendments to the Constitution came from real-life practical experience. Especially, the 4th, unreasonable search and seizure, freedom of speech. What I love about the 2nd Amendment, to go off topic a moment,
sure,
is that it is the second shortest in words of all the amendments, but it is the only amendment that speaks to duty. The duty to protect the security of a free state. like the people had the right to keep and bear arms. And the term militia is used, but the problem is people don't look to 1790 to understand how George Mason understood the word militia. Hmm. They look to today. Militia to George Mason was all the people except a few politicians. So yeah, the militia is the people, not some military group established by a governmental agency. No.
Yeah, absolutely.
We got a great founding. We need to get back to it. We need to take care of it. And we need to understand how our monetary system, as I said earlier, I believe, this is an all-inclusive problem. We're all going to have disagreements on other areas, but we are all desperately hurt by this system. This is the big unifier.
Yeah, because kind of like you were saying, I mean, we all have to use that money, whether we're a millionaire, on welfare or whatever. You know, you got to use that money to get the goods and services. It's that universal piece of transaction. So,
and what we'll get to in other episodes is, because some people might say, okay, Alan, I get it, but there's nothing wrong with our monetary system. I'm fine with it. It's okay. It's not a problem. I don't feel any negative effects. Well, stay tuned.
Yeah.
Because I will talk about the three absolutely massive negative effects that we suffer through every day because of this monetary system.
Yeah, I mean, I put them in the same camp as the people that will always say, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, so I don't mind if Siri is listening to my conversations or if I have to go through a checkpoint and show my ID and all this stuff. I'm like,
I've heard that before.
Oh, my goodness.
And I've heard people say they've actually said that, and
yeah.
I'm thinking, you are one moment away from saying something that all of a sudden has become unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is terrible. It is just, if you cannot engage in honest, open, reflective speech, and openly disagree without going crazy or negative or violent, and just have the discussion. Okay. To me, you know, this idea of safe space is that we get to have the discussion. We get to own what we believe, and we get to be respectful in listening to somebody that we don't agree with. And my education that taught me about the First Amendment was that I support the right for someone to say something that I will fight a lifetime against.
Exactly.
That's freedom of speech.
That's it.
Not, you only get to say what I like and otherwise be quiet.
Yeah, it's that sort of old JFK quote, which I'll paraphrase because I can't think of it, but something to the effect of those who make peaceful dialogue impossible make violent conflicts inevitable, something to that effect.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of where we're at.
We can disagree and be respectful. We can disagree and work to understand why someone sees something so differently than we do. That's part of the process of being in this country and being part of it, which is an amazing situation, but we need to take care of it. And as many issues as we have that are divisive by nature going on in the country today, the great unifier, the great all-inclusive problem is our monetary system. And in future episodes, you know, I look forward to getting into the real heavies about how the system really works, how it's working against us, and ultimately what the call to action is. Because it is very doable, and it's not complicated. And ultimately, I tell people, if you've got 10 minutes a day for your country, you can get this done.
You can cut off the Netflix, stop playing with your silly device, and just sit there for 10 minutes and think about where we're going.
10 minutes a day. That's all it takes.
Well, that sounds terrific, Alan. I look forward to speaking to you more and more in the coming weeks here and really sort of hashing out the solutions to these problems that we got.
Excellent. For those listening, next time we'll talk about Module 6, and it's who and how creates M1 money today in the USA. How's that?
That sounds terrific. And for the listeners out there, please check out AnomicAge.com. You can find all of Alan's links and bio underneath guest media. So just in case you'd like to know a whole lot more about Alan, and check out his links, they'll be there available for you.
Can I make one suggestion or offer?
Please.
If anybody, just to make it simple, if anybody listening has any questions, comments, please send them to John. He'll get them to me, and I will respond.
That's absolutely correct.
Or we'll deal with them on the next episode.
Sounds great.
John, thank you so much for having me. I really, really enjoyed this time with you.
Me too, Alan. Thank you so much, man. I look forward to talking to you next week.
Look forward to it, too. Be safe and well.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Be safe out there. Bye-bye. I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us today on the Anomic Age. Thank you very much for tuning into the program. And thank you, because I know you're doing it, for sharing the show links, AnomicAge.com, sending those videos to your friends from YouTube and Brighteon, hitting the like button as always. And if you have a little monies you'd like to share, because this ain't cheap, you can go to AnomicAge.com, and you can find on the right-hand side a great way to link up to a PayPal account that I will receive monies from. You can do the same thing on Twitter as well. So, please support the broadcast in any way that you can. It's going to have to be a grassroots movement, folks. Grassroots all the way. It's going to have to be. It's going to have to be people sharing the links. You know, writing stuff on a letter and putting it in the mail. Writing stuff on monies. Making your own stickers and putting them on the car. I got some stickers sitting here. I need to get out there. I know. I'm working on it. But all the above and then some. That's how it's going to have to be from now on. Because the social media marketing's out. I'm not putting a banner on a plane or any of that. I can't afford that jazz. But it's going to be up to us, up to you, up to me to get the message out there. So please do so, AnomicAge.com. Hope you really enjoyed our guest, Alan Myers, today. Don't fear, he'll be back next week and the following to sort of wrap things up with these a little bit shorter segments. We'll be getting into all things money, Federal Reserve, and then some. So, until next time, remember you can't do everything, but you can assuredly do something. Every little bit helps. No one's part is very insignificant. Everyone's part as a big orchestra has to work together. So whether you're playing the flute or the banjo, play it. Do your part. Stay safe out there, and I will see you next time on the Anomic Age. Be seeing you.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age. I'm gonna go to bed.